This is a collection of recordings I made with some of the world's most knowledgeable, well-known, and successful whitetail hunters on the planet. I know you're really going to enjoy and learn from the wisdom they share, along with their personal life and their walk with God. I hope you enjoy these classic conversations. Okay, I have got Russell Thornberry. And Russell, now, where are you located right now?
I'm in the foothills of the Alberta Rockies, in halfway between Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and then 60 miles west. And it is beautiful right now.
Man, it's good to have you here today. And guys, you're going to be listening to this. I know you're going to get a lot of knowledge from Russell. He is, he's been in the whitetail world for, I think we were talking, like 54 years?
Yes, I'm afraid that's true. I'm glad to still be here, though.
Well, we're glad you're here because I know there's going to be a lot of wisdom that we're going to be able to hear from you. Now, you're originally from the Lone Star State.
Yes, from the Republic of Texas, as they say. Yeah. Corpus Christi, to be exact.
You know, I was reading again, you and I have some things in common as I was looking at. You're a songwriter. Still to this day, you're a songwriter.
Yes, sir, I am. And have been since, golly, let's see, back in the, mid-60s, I guess, when I started. Of course, back then, I guess I did what every football player that gets shot in the foot does, and that's go into music business. And it was just a hobby, which turned into a passion. And then I actually, it was involved for many years professionally.
Now, I see you've got 9 BMI awards for original songs.
Yes, sir.
And I see, was it 3 number one hit records on songs that you wrote and performed?
Yes, that's correct.
Man, we haven't even gotten into the hunting stuff. I'm still looking at this and going, this is more than what most people will do in a lifetime. This is unreal.
You know, it's funny. I feel like I've lived several different lifetimes, end to end some way. But
I think a lot of guys will know you, you know, obviously from, you know, the Outdoor Channel. There's been appearances on Buckmasters Magazine TV and the Jackie Bushman Show. You know, a lot of us are familiar with.
Sure.
I know you host the Sportsman Afield.
Yes.
There's Wild Encounters, there's Adventures Abroad. I love hunting Africa myself, and I saw some of your photographs. That is an amazing place. But we can.
Boy, I'll tell you, that's we could do a whole week's worth on Africa. Oh. But alas, I'll stick to whitetails.
Yeah, it's just everything there wants to stick here or kill you.
I know it, and there's so much.
Let's kind of start moving into a direction here. I know that, you know, guys will know you from Buckmasters, you know, magazine. You mentioned earlier you were the editor-in-chief for 25 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
They contacted me, or Jackie Bushman did, when he got the idea to start a Deer Hunters Association. And being from Montgomery, Alabama, had watched Ray Scott do something similar with bass fishing. I'm sure everybody knows of Bassmasters.
Oh, yeah.
And he wanted to emulate that. But for whitetail hunters, Ray told him it wouldn't work, and he tried it anyway, and much to all of our amazement, it did work. And so when he realized that one of the things he was going to need was a magazine, he called me and asked me if I would, you know, create a magazine for him. And, you know, I didn't have enough sense to say no. And so I jumped in with both feet, and here we are.
Well, I see you speak, you know, events all across the country. I'm sure you do in Canada as well.
Yes.
When you get a young kid, maybe you have a new young kid coming in for the first time, or even an adult who's a novice, who want to be successful, and we really want to keep them in this industry to, you know, again, you know, fight for the passion that we all have for this. What would you say to them to help them, you know, maybe be more successful as a new hunter starting out?
Whitetail hunting is and should be a process, not simply an event. We tend to think of the event as getting the deer on the ground, which is great, but if the process is no fun, it won't be long before the event's no fun either.
Yeah. Oswald Chambers, I know if you've ever read any of his stuff, which
sure.
I'm sure you have, he says, you know, it's not about the end. He says the process is the end.
That's right. That is the destination is the journey. And your case in point, and I want to address the interest certainly of hunters, but the other day I was sitting in a tree stand, and up here in Alberta where I live, it's an unusual population of great gray owls, and one was sitting on a tree tip just about 30 yards from me, and I watched him as he swooped down and grabbed a mouse or something like that. And I mean, that I didn't shoot a deer that day, but I did see that gray owl do that, and I saw a fox bobbling across the meadow, and I saw a phenomenal woodpecker that was, you know, really eaten up with his desire for some termites. And it was thrilling to me. And so that's you know, part and parcel of the journey. You know, smell the roses.
Yeah. What about the guys that are coming to the events or asking you questions that have a lot of years under their belt? They're experienced. They've been doing this a long time. And they've bought all the stuff they see in the magazines, yeah. And they're out right. trying to do all the stuff, and they're going, man, I'm still not being as successful as I'd like to be. What could you pass on to these guys?
Well, let's you know, you and I happened on the subject of broadheads as per a question that you had posted on Facebook the other day, and it just happens that my curiosity about what constitutes the ultimate broadhead. Because of my own confusion of trying to look at promotion and so forth and so on. And so finally, here's what I found out, and here's how I found it out. I just did a simple test. The subject for the test was a 200-pound wild boar that I had taken, and while he was still all in one piece, I propped him up on his brisket, and with an 80-pound bow shooting a 31-inch 2317 aluminum shaft with a 150-grain broadhead. So we're talking about 660 grains of arrow shot out of an 80-pound bow. I shot three basic broadhead types, and their types were defined by what types of tips were on the heads. One was the oldest design, actually designed by primitive man, which was just simply a flat two-bladed broadhead that came to a point at the tip. The other was a chisel tip, steel chisel tip, followed by blades. And the third was a conical or a bullet tip, followed by inserted blades. I don't even see those made anymore, and for good reason. Mm-hmm. And so what I wanted to know was, I actually had a man making me a pressure gauge where I could put a piece of arrow shaft with these three heads interchangeably and press them into the hide of this wild boar between his ribs and see how much pressure it took to break the skin. Now, this was the first half of a two-part test. So this was what you will call a static test, meaning that we didn't factor in the speed of the arrow, just pressure. And the razor-sharp two-blade tip went through the hide and into the vitals under a three-arrow average of 1.25 pounds. The chisel tip, which at that time was probably one of the most popular, I won't mention the name because it's not important, took 55 pounds of pressure to break the skin. And the conical tip took 82 pounds of pressure. Mm. And so you have 1.25 pounds versus 55 pounds versus 82 pounds. And what you have to understand is that the energy expended breaking the hide and penetrating, the less energy expended in that act, the more energy is left in the arrow to continue penetrating. So if you burn up 52 pounds of your precious kinetic energy just breaking the skin, you're being robbed. What I also realized was in this static test is that the actual cut to the tip, two-blade broadhead, cut an entry hole pretty much the exact width of the broadhead. The other two cut much larger entry holes, but I realized by watching that the reason was is they were actually bending the hide so far into the ribs that the blade started cutting before the tip actually broke through. So finally I realized that these claims of these immense entry holes was not an asset, but it was actually proof of a failure. And see, those are the things that you don't understand. And people would say, yeah, well, that's just, you know, that's, and so I said, okay, well, to be fair, let's prop this pig up, stand back at 30 yards and shoot three each of these broadhead designs into the pig. And all three of the cut-on-contact tips went through the pig and are still at large somewhere in the South Texas brush country. Two of the tips with the chisel tip broke through the offside, and one did not make it all the way through, but none of them completely passed through the animal. And two of the three conical tips bounced off the hog, and one went inside because it hit another broadhead hole.
Unbelievable.
And so, you know, these are things you can't argue with. Now, let me take it to, I don't want to burn up all our time, but let me tell you something really fascinating that I found out incidentally. I shot the and still do, the two-blade cut-on-contact head. And when I typically shoot a deer or an animal with that, especially, say, if I'm in a tree stand, either the deer will take a couple of hops and look around and then fall over, or sometime just look around and then finally buckle in their tracks without even moving. Mm-hmm. And being as I was in hunting camps all over the country, when the outfitter would come to pick me up and the deer's laying right there under the tree, they said, well, how did you do that? I said, well, I didn't do anything in particular, I just shot it. And we realized that other hunters shooting different types of broadheads were making identical shots, good double lung shots, and, you know, 150, 200 yards to recover their deer. The issue was that cut to the tip two blade broadhead passes through with so little resistance that the felt pain that the deer experienced, the trauma, was so minimal that they didn't realize they were is even a problem. And case in point, shot a buck one day from a tree in an alfalfa field that was feeding. When the arrow stuck in the ground beside him, he lifted his head, looked around, reached down to grab another mouthful of alfalfa and fell over. Shot through a mule deer in British Columbia that the arrow stuck in an aspen tree behind him, and because of the noise, he turned around and went over to see what it was, and then buckled right under the arrow sticking out of the tree. Now, I'm speaking to the issue of trauma because of the design of the broadhead, but here's what the basis really is. I've met three people, one of whom was a guide of mine, who had a cut to the tip, two-blade broadhead go through some part of their body, and not one of them knew it. There was so little trauma, so little felt pain, that until they actually looked down and saw that they were hemorrhaging, they did not know what had happened to them. So, you know, that's the information that you don't see on the wrapper. And here's kind of the wrap-up on this whole thing. Back when I started learning about this, there were hardly any cut-to-the-tip, cut-on-contact broadheads available. Everything was replaceable blades with ferrules and various different kind of tips. And the manufacturers really poo-pooed, if you will, the old style. This is the new. This is the better. Mm-hmm. However, over the course of time, if you look at what's available now, there has never been in history of archery more cut-to-the-tip designs available commercially than they are now. So the same people who said they didn't work have come to realize, I think, what they knew all along, and so the archer never had it better.
Well, and even a lot of these manufacturers now have gone to the, even if they're using an expandable, they've gone to the cut-on-contact tip.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's precisely the point.
What a great point that when you're shooting that two-blade, because of all the more pressure it really took to break the hide, you don't have these massive, you know, entry holes where a lot of these companies are claiming, look at the size of these, when really what's happening is it's stretching the hide out.
Yeah, and it's robbing the kinetic energy. And the thing is that complete pass-through, especially for a bow hunter who's likely to have a little bit high entry and a low exit, it's really, really critical that they get that pass through. And the reality is that if you're shooting a 40-pound bow with a well-tuned arrow turning on its axis with the right broadhead, you'll shoot through the deer every time. Another thing, while we're on this subject, I'll conclude with this, is they've often said, well, the two-blade doesn't leave a blood trail. Anybody that said that has never shot anything with a razor sharp two-blade broadhead. The thing that we need to understand is that when the edge is so sharp that it slices without doing any tissue damage, the hemorrhaging is the greatest. And if you, back in the old days, I realize I'm aging myself, but you cut yourself in the old days with a regular shaving razor or a safety razor, and it bleeds and it bleeds and it bleeds, although it's a tiny little cut. This is because the tissue damage did not happen. It was just a clean slice, and without bruising or tissue damage, the brain does not release the coagulant into the bloodstream. And so the more tissue damage is done, the less hemorrhaging. And regardless of what the promo said, arrows kill by hemorrhage, not by impact, not by bone crushing. Mm-hmm. That's irresponsible to go there. It's about, and I keep saying I'm winding down, but the other fact that you need to know is, too, that and this is going to reach into another aspect of technology, but the saying that the cut on contact, cut to the tip type two-blade broadhead won't stabilize in your bow, that's false. If it's tuned, it will definitely stabilize in your bow up to 275, 280 feet a second maximum, after which no fixed-blade broadhead can be stabilized. That's why the collapsible mechanical broadhead was invented, because speed exceeded the ability of the broadheads of that era to fly right. The fallacy was that, sure, the target tip would fly perfectly, but the dynamics of blades put a whole different spin on things. And so for that reason, no matter what bow I shoot, I make sure, by whatever means, that I don't shoot more than 275 feet a second. And if I have to slow the bow down, I'll use a heavier arrow.
That's really a big point.
Yeah, and see, the thing, and the craze for speed, which can be justified in competition archery because of margin of error, but if it defeats the ability of your arrow to do its job in hunting, then it needs to be rethought.
Well, you've learned so much stuff, I know, through your years, because of being involved in this industry with magazines, hands-on experience, being a guide, working with guides, cameraman, all kinds of stuff. I'm sure there's some little whitetail lessons or tips or secrets that you could pass on, some things that these guys are waiting for right now that are going to go, man, tell me something that you've learned that has really changed the way you hunt whitetails. What would you say would maybe a couple of the biggest innovative things that have helped you become successful would be?
I think that to me, as a bow hunter, hunting for whitetails is something akin to trapping. I know if I can get that animal to place his foot in this spot, he's mine. So then it's a mind game about going about how do you get his foot in that spot. And there are the obvious situations, a deer coming into a field of something agriculturally pleasant to him, oats, corn, whatever. It's not rocket science to sit in a tree and hope that he walks by you. But there are instances where you may want to affect the travel route of a deer. And so whatever you're going to do, like, for example, I went on an island where there were many trails through the thickest brush in the world, and I went in there in July, once again, with some little snippers, and I just clipped off branches to open this trail up just enough so a deer could walk through more easily than going through all the briars and wild rose and that. And they adjusted to that trail happily because it was easier. If I'd done that 3 or 4 days before the season, they would not have even walked on it. So this is what subtle pressures that you can do if you start early. And by the way, it extends your season, so to speak. You get to be involved with your success, not just lucky one day, you know.
Yeah. Well, buddy, I want to ask you one last question. Before we do that, I know there's a lot of people that would love to have you come and speak, because I know you do the full package. You do some music. You've got a great personality, humor, but you've got so much knowledge. You'll be able to hold these guys' attention. If someone wanted to contact you, you know, to come and speak, or even finding your publications, your books, or whatever, how would they do that?
RussellThornberry.com, www.RussellThornberry.com. They can find me there. They can find my telephone information, email, you know, contact information, plus, you know, my bio, and, you know, pretty much anything anybody would want to know in deciding whether I'm the right guy will be there.
I see you're an ordained pastor.
I am. I have, of all men, have been so blessed by God, and I see men that are trying to rough their way through lives without the influence of a godly father, and they're making, you know, the familial mistakes that make life so tough. Life is hard. We sometimes labor under the illusion that the American dream is we're going to grow up, going to marry right, make a lot of money, and be happily after. If that's true, I'm still waiting to see the first example, because life is hard. Stuff happens, and we have to deal with it, and not only in this life, but the life beyond. And it is my passion to see men set free by the love of God and living to the fullest capacity of life now, not just something promised in our life in heaven, but there is a life to be lived on earth that is not for sissies. It's the greatest adventure that you can ever imagine.
Well, Russell, this has been one of the highlights for me. This whole project I've been working on is just speaking with you. And I know Charlie Alzheimer, when he was talking about his love for the Creator, I hear it. When you spend enough time outdoors and you see this amazing world that God made for us to be in and enjoy, that He's got an even greater adventure for us. This has been a highlight, just listening to you talk about your passion for the outdoors, but more importantly, your passion for the Creator, who made that stuff and made us. And I want to thank you for your time and your wisdom. And, buddy, just keep hunting for truth, and I hope to see you in the woods sometime soon.
Well, thank you, Brent.